We come to this topic, which is a hot one in many places, from at least two contexts or as members of at least two communities. Many of us who are gathered here are residents or citizens in the United States, and Americans, of course, have a particular take on questions about immigration or particular takes. And we also come as Christians, and I think that this is an issue, immigration and how we respond to newcomers, is an issue where those two identities of Christianity and our national citizenship come together in a particularly acute way, as we're concerned both about policy and practice. And I don't know that those always match, but it is one where those come together. And because I am a historian of American immigration, I'm going to say a little more at the beginning than I might about some other topics. And simply I want to say that I think as Americans, as we approach these topics, we need to keep in mind both the mythology about immigration and the changes in policies. Now, I use mythology in a very positive sense. That mythology is strong stories that tell us who we are. And we have a mythology in the United States about being a place that welcomes immigration, that's built on immigration, that's a national mythology. Many of us also have family stories about immigration, about how we and our ancestors got here. So that even if the experience is removed a generation or two, many Americans have a personal stake in immigration as a coming, and also what the experience is like once you arrive. And that's where changes in policy become very important. That the United States has changed its policy about immigration many times. But two changes in particular I might note, that after many decades of relatively open doors, in the 1920s, immigration was severely curtailed by a quota system, which was not meant to be representational. They played with those numbers a lot in the base years to get it to come out the way the legislators wanted. And essentially, what they came up with was a policy that was most open to the people who were at that point least likely to still be coming, so that those who had come earliest, particularly Anglo-Saxons, people from the United Kingdom, were most welcomed. Those from Northern Europe, somewhat more welcomed. And Southern and Eastern Europe, the least welcomed. That's what used to be called the new immigration from Southern and Eastern Europe. That's based partly on a change of understanding of human nature. That prior to that, there had been the assumption that anyone given the right opportunity could become a democratic small D American. A change in worldview about how people were meant that there was less belief that could happen. Then we have a period of about 40 years based on that, and in the 60s a reopening of immigration. So there's that change in policy. The second context is the one from our Christianity, and here we could go on and on, pointing to the Hebrew experience of being sojourners in a strange land, and how that theme is reiterated throughout the Old Testament as God says to the people, remember that this had been your life, that you were strangers and foreigners, and that you should welcome the stranger and the foreigner. There's also the issue of Christian citizenship not being in this world, but somewhere else. That might give us a place to think about this. And then a third way would be to look at, in particular, the role that Christians have played in the last decades in the United States with resettlement of various refugee groups. Jonathan has talked about this a little bit in his sessions. The sessions this week have really led us to this forum. So if any of you have been to Jonathan's sessions, Bob's sessions, Michael's, Jim Martin Schramm's, who left today, you're probably primed for this. But let's let these guys start. I've told them about 5 minutes each, And let's just go in this order. I've asked each of them to talk about their own experience and to reflect on what their experience with immigration might suggest for other people's practices and policies. So introduce yourself and then do that.
All right. I'm Bob Eklund, and I live in Burlington, Washington. I grew up in the Seattle area. And first of all, I am the grandson of an immigrant from Sweden. And he was the 10th of 10 children who all immigrated here and settled in the Midwest and then migrated and eventually made it to Washington State. So I'm speaking from that perspective. I traveled a lot in Central America in the beginning, the early part of the 80s, and worked for 6 years in a development project that was geared towards training peasants in subsistence strategies that would allow them to stay on the land, because all through Latin America there's a crisis in agricultural production that's leading many people to abandon their lands and head for the big cities and then oftentimes north to the United States. And this is the situation in Mexico as well. Anyway, our project, we could see that it took a lot of work to train, to help people develop subsistence strategies that would allow them to stay on the land. And we could also see that there are very, very few projects that are really trying to do that. And now we're working with migrant farm workers in Burlington. My wife and I have been working for a year there trying to start an ecumenical ministry to those folks. And I'm also working as chaplain in a jail. And that chaplaincy program started out as chaplain to the Hispanic immigrants in the jail. So my perspective is sort of changed. Before coming up here, I was an interim pastor of an inner city church in San Francisco. It was a bilingual Spanish-English church. And a lot of my youth group, in fact, most of them were gang members, and were a very sort of difficult group to work with. But what I saw there in the inner city was how many kids were sort of being sacrificed to the American dream. Many parents were working two jobs, each of them, and in order to subsist in San Francisco. And so their kids were basically not being parented and were in desperate need of some kind of group, and so they'd go with the gangs. And anyway, I was there just for a year before moving back up here and starting this ministry. Now I'm in an area where there's about 10,000 permanent Hispanic residents and about anywhere between 3,000 and 6,000 migrant farm workers who come in and just work 5 months out of the year. And about probably 60% of those people are illegal. They're undocumented people. So the ones that end up in the jail, probably even more than 60% of those are undocumented. And what I'm finding is that these people are a very necessary part of the economy in our area, which is a very big agricultural area. They, without them, I don't see how the farmers can make it. There's a lot of small farmers, and those folks are very dependent on the migrant farm workers for just a cheap source of labor. And the migrant farm workers are very dependent on these farmers for jobs, so it goes both ways. There's about 12 migrant camps, which are almost like refugee camps. They're real minimal housing. Each house houses anywhere from 7 to 15 people. They're just like little one-room places with tin roofs. And these are the people that I work with. I visit them on a weekly basis. And I'm trying to begin a number of Bible studies in some of the camps and reach out to these people. Now, what I've noticed in the last two or three months has been just a major onslaught of Border Patrol people in our area. They've been coming and rounding up Hispanic people out of the grocery stores, stopping them as they drive along on the main streets of the towns where we live, and pulling them over and harassing them and requesting documents. And a lot of these people don't have documents, or they have false documents, and so immediately they're handcuffed and thrown in the back of a car and hauled off to the county jail, and then from there they're taken down to a big holding tank prison down in Seattle. And every 2 weeks there are about 70 people that are put in a bus, handcuffed to the rails, and taken all the way down to Tijuana and dropped off. Most of these people are people who have families who they're leaving behind in apartments or in migrant camps. And so the families are separated. The families, usually the women, will work as well in the fields, picking raspberries or blueberries or whatever the season is. But it's very hard to make it on one person's income, especially when you have anywhere from 3 to 7 children. So I'm finding myself involved in lots of immigration issues. and directly involved in these sorts of questions, like, how do I respond to these folks? And how do I respond to the churches that are supporting me, or that I'm trying to raise support from? There's a lot of anti-immigrant sentiment in our county, a lot of feeling that these people should go, and that they're a drain on our society. But most of the people that I meet are not getting any support from the state, besides maybe WIC, which is only appropriated. They're only able to get it if they're pregnant or have small children, and then they can get health care as well. But it's not like they're getting food stamps or any other benefits. So I feel like there's a lot of people that aren't informed about sort of the benefits that are available to these immigrants. Anyway, my feeling as a Christian is that a lot of people say, well, what do you think? Should we just open the borders? And what should we do? I mean, is that what you're calling for? And I tend to say, well, that's not my problem. There's plenty of people that are in charge of monitoring the borders. And my role as a Christian has nothing to do with monitoring borders and checking to see whether someone's legal or illegal. My role is to welcome the foreigner, welcome the immigrant, and to try to announce the gospel to these people, and to try to support them in concrete and creative ways as I can, and to try to enable other Christians and other people in the community to get to know these people and to build relationships that are mutually beneficial. So the biggest issue, though, is how do we deal with this, the Border Patrol, who are increasingly abusive. But that's, I guess we can stop there.
Thanks, Michael.
My name is Michael Moller. I live in Philadelphia. I'm what you call a resident alien. And the term alone already shows some ambivalence, I think, about how people that come to this country are viewed officially and unofficially. I come from a country and a situation where people would probably expect it would be fairly easy to get into the United States. I come from Germany, that is a very rich country, so I'm not suspected to be an economic refugee. I'm married, we have two children, so it's a real marriage, not a fake marriage. I'm white, and I'm well educated. I have a PhD that I got my education in Germany, so nobody in the United States had to pay for that. So you would expect that for me it would be fairly easy to get into this country, or immigration would be a fairly easy thing to do. But it is not. It was extremely complicated, and the harassment and the bureaucracy and the forms that I had to fill out and the complications and what I had to go through indicated clearly to me that the way the system is set up is not very welcoming to strangers. Now, if I think about how I would be treated if I would be non-English speaking, person of color, under the suspicion of being an economic refugee, under the suspicion of maybe using my marriage to get into the country, and so on and so on, I can maybe start to begin to imagine how people from Central America, from other parts of the world that are less fortunate than Western Europe, what they might feel and what they have to go through to get into this country. I think what is astonishing to me when I talk to American citizens is that most of them think that all the rest of the world only wants to come here to take advantage of what this country has to offer. Not very many people think about somebody coming to this country as somebody who has something to offer to this country. They think of it that somebody comes here to get something, not something to bring something. And I think that if you want to make this country a more welcoming country to strangers, that's the first thing you need to change. I don't think that all the rest of the world wants to live in the United States and thinks this is the greatest and the best country of all. But that it is a country that offers opportunity and offers and has disadvantages over other countries. The second point I would like to make is I come from a country that, of course, has very similar problems in regard to immigration than the United States. Germany has more refugees and immigrants than the rest of Western Europe combined. And that has to do with the Constitution of Germany that guarantees political asylum to any person who is persecuted in the world. The United States gives asylum to people, but the asylum seekers do not have a right to be granted asylum. If you go to Germany, you have the right to be granted asylum. It is your right, even if you are not a German. That's unprecedented. I know of no other country that would guarantee by its constitution rights to non-citizens. It has to do, of course, with the experience of Nazi Germany and the guilt and the atrocities that were committed by Germans in the Second World War. Now, recently that has led to a big debate on immigration. Actually, there were tendencies even to change the constitution because people felt that Germany just has too many refugees and too many people taking advantage. The way it goes is that if you ever want to go to Germany and live there, you just need to step on German soil, that's the condition, and claim that you're a political refugee. And then you can claim that right, and then you have the right to stay in Germany as long as the courts have decided that you are entitled to that right, and that can take up to 15 years. So people think that in Germany that some people that are not political refugees take advantage of this article in the Constitution, and therefore people wanted to change it. You have heard about hostility toward foreigners in Germany. That, by the way, takes place not only in Germany but in other countries as well, in France, in even in Scandinavian countries that we think of as very civilized, and in Switzerland as well. I think that, of course, every country has the right to control the entrance and exit of people to a certain degree. And therefore, if somebody would ask me if we should open the border and let everybody in, I would say, of course not. We can't do that. But I think what people in the United States and in Western Europe have to realize is that that you have to debate this question in a fair way, not with the great emotion that are put into the debate right now, but also to consider that the Western European and the American society is building its high living standard and its economic success certainly on the cost of other people. And therefore, the problem of immigration cannot be solved simply by closing the border. That's an illusion. If people think that that is the way to deal with it, that's wrong. It will not work. We have heard about that this morning in Jim Schramm's presentation about refugees and the statistics. I think the key question lies in the fact that economic assistance needs to be provided to other countries so that less people feel the economic and the political need to escape to flee their countries. And I think one thing needs to be said quite clearly. To be a refugee, even if you come from the poorest country, is not something that people desire. Don't think that people just waiting in their houses to become refugees and make it to the Holy Land of whatever that is But being a refugee is always something less desirable. And therefore, I think in the long term, a strategy that would help those people to find economic opportunities and political freedom in their own countries would be the strategy that would solve the problem.
Thank you. I'm Dave Nagler, and I serve a church down by San Diego about in an affluent beach community. There's three of us at that church, and our context for ministry is kind of interesting. I think one of the most stark observations of contrast that I've ever experienced is being right at the border where San Diego and the United States meet Tijuana and Mexico. And Tijuana is a city that 25 years ago had about 20 to 25,000 people in it. And it has swelled in 25 years to over a million. And there is no significant change in the infrastructure of that city in terms of roads, sewage, electricity. A lot of those things are more or less still geared towards that original level. Consequently, you have pretty abject poverty and a real bleak existence if you go away from the shopping areas, that is. If you go away from the downtown where you can buy things cheap, you have a very bleak kind of marginal third world existence buttressed right up against a very affluent first world existence. And it's interesting, you can stand on hills in Tijuana and look across and see the gleaming buildings of San Diego right there. It's almost like you could touch it. And so consequently, as long as that situation exists, with such poverty next to such affluence, you will have people who want to move across for economic means. I mean, it's very clear. I'm also in a state that has tried to deal with that in many different ways, and the most recent being Proposition 187, which many of you may know of, in which the Californians, on a two-to-one margin, voted that they wanted to rescind state-supported services of medical aid and education to children or any undocumented worker, or education to their children. And so what seems to me is what's going on, especially being in an affluent area, like a beach community, is one, there's the problem of fear. There's a real fear about what is happening to our area, what is happening to our communities. I live in an area that has a large floral industry, and so consequently there's an increasing number of Hispanic people moving to our area. Interestingly enough, a lot of them are from Central America and not from Mexico, but they're coming up through Tijuana. There's a group of people who help them get across the border. They're called coyotes, you know what that is? And they will charge them a sum of money to get their family across. Now, harrowing experience. But once they're there, they now are interfacing with this, like I said, rather affluent community. California has to deal with a major issue, and that's they want to have their cake and eat it too. We want to be able, in California, it seems, to have extremely low-wage labor. And at the same time, and it's not just in the agriculture business in our area. It's in pretty much every business has got extremely low-wage, sub-minimum wage set labor wages. We want that, but at the same time, we don't want to have to provide the benefits, pay taxes on those wages, pay Social Security, pay the disabilities insurance, pay for all those things that then will increase the infrastructure that can provide the services. So what's happened over time is there's been this animosity that's built. And it's really, I've lived in California all my life. And it's to the point right now where it's really getting quite violent. There's a real increasing sense amongst the Anglos of even more stereotyping than in the past, even more a sense of we're going to make sure that they aren't getting things from our children. We have an incredible amount of white flight out of the public schools and into private schools, which they then want to pass referendums in the state legislature to help get paid for. And then we've also got an increasing sense of anger on the part of the Hispanic community. I was involved in several of the marches against Proposition 187, and in those marches were lots of very angry people who were waving Mexican flags and saying we ain't gonna take this anymore. There's an interesting idea that came out through one of the agencies. They wanted to see if we could organize enough of the undocumented workers to take a week off. And what would happen to the California economy if the undocumented workers just took a week and refused to work, even for the substandard wages? We would have seen how much we need them. So our state is facing an incredible crisis coming up here. I want to be able to say to my affluent community that is largely conservative in its political outlook, you have a point, as Michael was saying. We have to figure out a way to say something about immigration that has limits. I mean, because of the incredible needs and resources that aren't there, and the incredible needs and the lack of resources that wouldn't be there. But at the same time, we have to be able to say, as Christians, how do we respond? How do we respond and reach out in love to those people who are in our communities and to those people who are on the other side of the border? It's an incredibly complex situation. One of the best things we've tried to do has been just exposure and relationship building through different work projects, through different sort of touring facilities like orphanages and other churches. And there's a Lutheran, by the way, it's a Lutheran retreat center in Tijuana that'll charge you $3 a night to stay there. It's a great place to go. And you can meet a lot of people who are trying to do things on the other side of the board to make it a better place to be. But I have to come back that's my pastor said, but I also have to say as a father, if I was on that side of the border, and the fact that I'm not is an accident of birth, if I was on that side of the border, I would be over here working illegally. Absolutely. Positively. I can say that without any sense of hesitation. And you know why? Because I'd be doing just what most of the men are doing who are coming over. They're working and they're sending the money back so that their families can have a better life. And they don't want to live here. They want to live back there. They want to live back in the other countries. They just want to be able to do something to make a better world for their children and for their families. It's exactly what I do.
Okay. Good. Thank you. Next. What do we do? What do we think? Responses? Questions? I do notice some terminology shifting, which is an interesting thing that happens. I'm trying to remember who it was. Maybe Dick Solberg in his book about the Lutheran Immigration Refugee Services. So the 19th century was the century of the immigrant, and the 20th century is the century of the refugee. Shift how we talk about things.
How can, in San Diego, how can they have the illegals and not pay taxes on them and not have the government down on them?
There's the big rub. If the other side of 187 would say, if you want to solve the problem, we need to enforce the laws that are already on the books that exist to address what you're saying. But the same people who are enforcing those laws or who are not enforcing those laws are also involved in the business side of it. And it behooves those who are in power not to enforce those laws, except occasionally in a big raid on and make a big headline splash. We just completely took out this one factory, and they were amazing. It was full of undocumented workers, which any day of the week you could find. I mean, anyone in Southern California knows where you could find lots of undocumented workers if you wanted to do such a thing. But because the owners are getting away with not paying the taxes and the wages that they should, that's what's going on. But we also have to bring it the next step too. I had a friend of mine who was Ukiah, and he, before that, he grew grapes and raisins in the San Joaquin Valley. And he, in seminary, took a lot of heat because he admitted paying substandard wages to undocumented workers. And they're saying, how could you do that? Boy, treat them like they're regular Americans. You have to pay them full price. And he said, look, I paid them the best I could, given the standard of wage in that area. And unless you want to pay another dollar for raisins and buy my raisins, then I can't do it. It really comes down to the fact that we all are benefiting from this cheap labor system, and yet we don't want to pay the into the infrastructure that's going to take care of these people. We want them to work and then go away.
That's an important point, I think. In the debates that I heard in this country, it's always, these immigrants, if they just would go away, then the problem would be solved. But there are two more levels of people involved. First of all, there would be no illegal immigrants if they wouldn't be employed illegally. If they wouldn't find employment, they wouldn't come here. And that means there are people who take big economic advantage or some small economic advantage of them for their own gain and exploit them. But then, secondly, there's a second level to that, and that's us. Mm-hmm. Who buy stuff only if it is a certain price level, and who we are not willing to pay more. Now, I don't think that if we would only spend more money on some other goods, we would solve the problem. It's kind of a very complex situation where all the levels enforce each other. But what should become clear is that there is no one guilty group, and the rest is innocent. But it is a complex structure, and there are a lot of people who benefit from the situation. In my presentation today, I asked people, where are Holden t-shirts made from? We think of Holden as this great community that is beyond all these questions. And somebody looked at the label, made in China. So we are part of this whole economic deal that exploits probably sweatshop workers in China that get maybe 50 cents an hour, no healthcare, work 15 hours a week. We are part of it, who buy. Even in Holden, there's no escape from that.
Sarah? Michael, I'm glad you brought this to economics, because I think that's the crux of the matter. Mm-hmm. And it's not just us buying t-shirts. It has to do with World Bank policies and mm-hmm. structural adjustment programs worldwide. And you just sort of briefly talked about providing aid to countries so that people won't want to come here. I mean, we steal the labor of those countries and then are very resistant to trying to give back to those countries in any way. So we're really talking about massive restructuring of the world economic priorities. That's a tough one for Christians. Secondly, I'm glad to hear you say we're all complicit and we're, there's not good guys and bad guys here. I see that. I live in Los Angeles. So in California, we're still deep in a recession. It's going to get worse. And I think California is a bellwether for the nation. Why is it getting worse? For the same reason that people are coming here from Mexico and Nicaragua or wherever, for the same World Bank structural adjustment policies. I mean, something like 20 years ago, the highest paid worker in an industry might make 13 times what the lowest paid worker does. Now it's 43 times. So there's this huge gap, not just worldwide, between the have-nots and the haves, but in California. And I think it's true in other parts of the United States, too. So it's really easy to talk about immigration in terms of not being welcoming or wanting to be charitable toward, good Christians towards other people. But to me, it comes down to money and how money is in capital and how it's used and where it's invested and where it's not being invested. don't have anything to say about how we do that.
And even if we had our, we could keep all the immigrants out, that would keep the big multinationals from going down to Honduras, El Salvador, and other places and setting up their sweatshops. In the town where we worked for all those years, there was a Kennecott Copper Company that was trying to put in an open pit copper gold mine. You know, and they, fortunately, it was stopped after a lot of organizing and resistance. But, you know, but there's plenty of other examples where big companies are just making incredible profits off of cheap labor in Central America, Mexico.
There is.
Yeah. Not only is there an immigration problem, if you do the reverse, there's a migration problem. And the migration is our industries, and not only our industries, but corporate world, looking for cheap labor markets because we're not sure how long we can have this kind of immigration policy where we say, you're not welcome, but we'll take all we can get.
Right.
You know, and so now we are setting up factories and industry all over the place. So that adds to complexity. And the other complexity, which I suppose is kind of an interesting ethical question, let's just buy America. And what does that mean? And what does that do? And is that possible? And what does that do to the people of the third world that are just eking out a living? I mean, we could all go to the Jubilee shop, and there they have cooperatives and all that and stuff. But what happens in China if all of us, it won't happen, but just hypothetically, we cease to buy there? What happens to their economy as a result of our good Christian attitude?
But I think you are right, but there are things that people can do. One example that hasn't to do with immigration, but you have heard probably in Europe about the Shell platform in the North Sea, and the Shell oil company wanted to sink it. And there was massive consumer protest all over Europe, boycotting of Shell. And so on, and they finally were forced to give up plans to do that. Certainly, I think we could do the same if it is clear, for example, child labor. A lot of the stuff that we are consuming in this country is produced by child labor. I think that's an enormous problem, particularly in Asia. I think we need to be more aware of that, and we need to, we base our consumer decisions simply on the price most of the time. I think that is not acting responsibly. We need to know more about where do these things come from. Just one example, I used it before, the sweatshop in Los Angeles where I think 30 or 40 Thai workers were held hostage, 70 even, for many years, working 17, 20 hours a day. Now, they were producing Gap and other brand name clothing, and all the companies issued statements right away. We had no idea that was going on. And if we would have known, we of course would never have used this outlet to purchase our products. Now I think we need to make it a responsibility of people that sell to know where they get their goods from, so that they can be held responsible if they sell stuff that is produced by children, stuff like that.
Here,
I live in Southern California. I just have a problem with the idea that we tend to think that Hispanics are the only people who are illegally in our country. There are many au pairs and nannies, that type of people coming from Northern Europe who are brought into this country illegally, come in legally, encouraged to stay illegally by you and others in the Lutheran Church, in the Christian Church, who just feel that it's okay to have a nanny come. Governor Pete Wilson had illegal help and it was all okay at that time. But many, many people in Southern California, they're either hiring Hispanics to do this work, or they feel nothing is wrong with bringing in students from Europe and letting them overstay their visas and staying for a year or two while they help raise their children or clean their house or whatever. So it's not just the Hispanics. We seem to always, and it's a racist thing, I believe, that we pick on the Hispanics as the illegal aliens. Both words I do not like anyway. They're undocumented workers. I don't know of any place else. I'm an immigrant. I was born in England. I came here over 30 years ago. Been a citizen for over 30 years. But the idea, when I lived in England, I don't recall anybody being referred to as an alien. But here, we like to call people who are not Americans aliens. I'm not sure why. But I just like to kind of set the story straight that it's not just Mexicans, Hispanics, South Americans, Central Americans that are draining our system. There are many other people that are draining it and are being paid substandard wages because they're au pairs or nannies or whatever.
And there are lots of Mexicans, too, who are U.S. citizens.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Hispanic people who are, you know, Chicanos. And in our area, you know, probably 50% at least are legal residents, if not citizens. And these people, oftentimes they're pulled over by the Border Patrol when they're driving down the street just because they have, you know, black, dark hair and a darker complexion, just because they look Mexican.
How many... can you still get legal status if you were a Mexican coming into this country?
It's impossible to get to come in legally unless you're very wealthy.
Well, they won't say impossible. They'll say, "Oh, there's an avenue, of course, but just try it." I mean, on paper, yes, you can, but there's a very few spots and there's very stringent.
So
qualifications. Exactly.
Are there any groups that can come in legally to this country anymore without a lot of people?
I can't speak. I don't know.
There's
Cubans.
There are two kinds. We heard about this morning. The people that that come here for family reasons or for work reasons. So for example, if your employer tells the INS that that no American could take this job, then you are allowed to immigrate, for example. A colleague of mine is from India, and the seminary wanted to hire him, and they had to fill out all kinds of forms and so on and so on, and he could emigrate. And then refugees, of course. And they can ask for asylum, and it might be granted. 80 to 85% are denied, and most of them stay then as illegal, because once they are in the country, they normally do not leave. And then there is a cap. What was that? 580,000 or so. So, for example, if I marry an American as a German. If the cap is reached, then I have to wait another year. They tell you, okay, wait. And there is a quota for countries, and that means, for example, for a country like Germany, the quota is relatively low, and that means then you have to wait longer. For Asian countries, it's very low, and then you have to wait for a long time, even if you have family here.
For the average farm worker, though, I work with a number of immigration lawyers in the Seattle area, and they say that they just have to tell people, basically, that there's no hope for them to get legal.
Mm-hmm. Last week, I just read in our Danish language newspaper there are 2,000 applications yearly for immigration to the United States, and they are picked out by a lottery, and 178 are admitted.
That's just from Denmark?
Yes. Yeah.
Because that's how the categories are
right.
made.
according to national origin.
I have a friend that's one of the head honchos in Gap of Levi, sorry, sister of mine. She got to fly into Thailand to see their job, where they, the people work, and she was shocked, but they're not going to change. I mean, she was hot, and I mean, she just described it in like 3 pages of a letter to me, but it's not, you know, she didn't say that she was going to change it. I mean, I think, you know, I don't even know if they know about it, if they're going to react to it. Do you see what I mean? I mean,
on one hand, you would hope for moral reasons that there would be a difference, but for business reasons, the business of America is business, that what Hoover said. I mean, there's a side that says that just as long as your competitor is going to do something cheaper, you may find yourself out of work. So I understand that reality as well. I don't say it's right, I just understand it, you know.
But I think there's a difference between, I think that most Americans would not react very strongly that people just are paid a lousy pay or something. So they say, well, it's too bad. But if it comes to holding people hostage in houses like prisoners, mm-hmm. Then I think a moral limit is reached, or when it comes to child labor and stuff like that. So I still think there's a lot we can do. I'm not as naive to think that we can change the world completely, but there is still a lot to do, even in these areas.
To keep everybody from getting a totally bad view of the nurseries and stuff in California, I work for a nursery. The people we hire, we do pay taxes on. We also pay Social Security on them. Most of them, we try to hire legals, but it gets difficult because they can make fake cards that are very difficult to tell real from unreal. They all come with Social Security cards, whether they're legal or unlegal. We pay into this number, whether it's legal. We, in the past, have had illegal people, and we have consistently paid into the Social Security. We deduct it from their check. They pay into it, too. Now, when they are taken across the border, they lose this all. And the Social Security office, we have called them because we've had a problem with one of our workers. And we have found out that the name does not match the number. Now, I'm sure this isn't the first time this has happened, because they all come across with numbers that do not match their names, or names that are, they're either their numbers wrong or their names wrong, or maybe both. But the United States government is continuing to keep this money, collect this money, even though they know that this person isn't the real person that got this number. Mm-hmm. So what's happening to this money?
Yeah, that's a lot of money. That's an awful lot of money, too.
Yes, you're right.
I know a lot of people that have tried to get their unearned income credit this year and haven't been able to get anything back because the IRS says, well, your name doesn't match your number. But
yeah.
15%, you know, a lot, large percentage of their income, what is it, 15% or something, was taken off their payroll.
And when we do offer insurance, we have an insurance program. If they stay there a year, they are eligible for insurance. Like I said, most of our workers were documented. Most of them were quite upset, I believe, that with this proposition that we had. I thought I detected even kind of a work slowdown because of it. And my boss did not think so, but it just seemed weird, because it seemed like for a while there was a different attitude. And
you know, if I could say one other thing about 187, you know, the tragedy of that has been, even though it was thrown into the courts and not enacted upon, the Hispanic population in our area doesn't, a lot of them don't realize that. Not all, some of them figure that out, but a lot of them don't. And so consequently, you have people who are not going to get medical treatment when they really need it, or who are feeling as though they can't trust anybody. If they talk to the wrong person, they're going to get instantly turned in and deported. They feel as though since this vote happened, and since they lost in a political battle on this side of the border, that they've lost everything in some ways.
Yeah. One thing I wanted to say about this, having a green card and being a Hispanic, You know, for Europeans, having a green card would mean something significant. But these days, I know large numbers of people who are in the prison, the INS prison in Seattle, who have green cards, but they're being held there, and they're being told that their court date is coming up. But normally they should shouldn't have to stay more than 15 days, but some have been in there 6 months without seeing a judge. And constantly they're being offered to sign a voluntary departure paper, but that's giving up your green card. And there's large numbers of them that are signing these voluntary departures and giving up their residency. And their families are on the outside. So there's a lot of pressure to try to take away people's green cards.
And if I may add, I mean, the California proposition is not the worst legal procedure that is right now presented in the United States. The Republican proposals say that they would even want to deny services to legal immigrants.
That's true, yeah.
I, as a taxpayer, would not be entitled to any kind of social program, federal programs, because I'm an immigrant. Only if I would decide to become a citizen, I would be entitled. Therefore, you have this great run of green card holders that want to become citizens, or because they don't feel safe anymore as legal immigrants.
We've said a lot about political and economic responses. You each said a little bit in your opening statements about what your response as a person of faith is. I wonder what you think about that. When we're confronted with this complex web of relationships, it begins to feel kind of hopeless, you know, because when you go out to buy a pair of jeans, sometimes it's hard enough just to find a pair that fits. And then you have to worry about who made them and how much they got paid. And, you know, you just think, well, better to move somewhere warm where I don't need clothes.
Yeah.
And then it will all be fine. No, of course I exaggerate, but...
Where you get your suntan oil.
Yeah, that's right. Well, where to get your suntan oil, especially if you have skin like mine. What do we say to one another when we face those kinds of quandaries? Mm-hmm. Not just about where your clothes come from, but what that means about the school district your kids go to school in, mm-hmm. and the kind of medical services that you get or don't get. What do you say to each other, Mary?
Well, one thing we can say to each other is, I know in the 60s and 70s, there were years and years when we never ate grapes or lettuce. Mm-hmm. If you can respond to a boycott, I mean, it must take so much time and energy for migrant workers to organize, to discover that Dole, when Guatemala said we're going to put 50 cents more on each box of bananas that goes out of here because you're ripping us off, and the Dole company just said, well, too bad, we're not going to take the bananas, and just left them rotting on the docks for days and days and days. If you find out something like that, just stop buying Dole products. I mean, it takes a lot of people to boycott, but I think in the past those things have really worked. I think we should encourage each other that it doesn't kill you not to eat grapes and lettuce or buy wine. It's maybe whatever.
So to not be afraid to do something that seems small.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but then as soon as you go and you look at the books like you have here in the resource book, or, you know, those library books that have all the companies that are horrible companies. And, I mean, it's like there's very little that is politically or religiously correct to buy, you know. And it's like it takes numerous hours to be able to figure it out. And then it changes. And then it's like, oh, okay, well, maybe South Africa is getting their act together now. We can all buy Shell or, I mean, you know, whatever. And it's like... I mean, you know, you got to also live your life in some way and go on with whatever you are. I mean, you know, and it's like, I don't know how you do that.
I don't know how to do it either. But good friend of mine who was fairly high up in control data talked about how they were trying to better the conditions in South Korea with their labor there. And they were probably paying about 80% above the mean average for the employee there. But because they were open to listen to the people in the United States here and stuff, the pressure kept coming and coming and coming and coming, and finally what they ended up doing is closing all their operation in South Korea because it just wasn't worth the liability. And they were one of the good companies over there, if I can believe them. And the second point is that I come back to Robert Lipton's point that the number one neurosis in our society today is psychological numbing. That when we're inundated with all this stuff, and almost every form leaves me this way, where do you go, what do you do, and to survive, we just stop feeling anything. And that's the dangerous thing about this, that we don't even do the simple steps.
I would like to speak to that. That's, I think that's because we think, okay, it all depends on my action and what I do, and I can't do it all. But I think we have to take into account that that what large companies do and what small companies do reflect on what we want them to do, as much as politicians. Unfortunately, I think that politicians are too much followers anyway than really leaders. But that means we need to get out of the sense of isolation, that we need to fight this battle, but we need to come up with ideas what we want and then tell people what we want rather than fighting all these little fights. And I think that companies will be quite responsive and politicians will be quite responsive if you can convince people that this is a good idea. So we shouldn't make it too easy on ourselves to say, I do it right, but unfortunately all the rest does it wrong. But we need to develop to argue for what we believe in. And that ties quite in this our Christian faith. We do the same with our faith, actually. I believe it, and therefore I'm okay, and I set it right for myself. Unless I'm able to convince others that what I'm believing in gives me strength, it doesn't make any difference. And therefore, we need to go out.
I see one hand back here of someone who hasn't spoken. I need to say we're about 5 minutes from the end. So if you're the kind of person who waits to see if someone else is going to say what you wanted to say and they haven't, now is the time.
Well, one of the panelists mentioned it earlier, but I think it was one. About just expose it. Like, I think I would trust that if we all knew which company to boycott it, we would do it. But there are lots of other people that wouldn't. And the kinds of contact that you talked about, more social, just people getting to know each other, I think is really important. I used to train volunteer tutors to teach English to refugees. And that, sure, it helped the refugees learn English. But I think one of the bigger jobs that those people did was when they would hear someone say, oh, the refugees are taking so many resources, they get all this welfare, the volunteer who had met a real life refugee could say, no, they only get welfare for this many months, and I know lots of families that have done this and that and that, and just to start that kind of education one-to-one, that it isn't, they aren't refugees, they're people. They aren't, Hispanics, they're farm workers, they're just like us in a lot of ways. And any kind of exposure like that, I think
that's totally right on, because I see, why don't we talk so much about our relationship with our products that we're consuming? We should be talking about a relationship with these people, with the producers. Mm-hmm. I know lots of people, I think boycotting in a lot of ways can be destructive. I see the farmers in our area there, mm-hmm. they don't want to have to deal with employees. It's just too politically incorrect, to be paying them minimum wages. They'd rather have a raspberry harvester. They'd rather pay, I don't know how many millions of dollars for several raspberry harvesters, which displace all kinds of workers. Those farm workers want to keep picking raspberries. They don't want a machine doing it. But we're pressuring. We don't want to pressure those growers to have to mechanize everything.
Are there others who've been waiting?
I would just add as an echo to say...
You haven't been waiting.
I'm sorry.
No, wait. And
okay,
see
I'll wait.
Someone
I'll wait.
Who's been
I'll
waiting. Wait. Okay. I'm sorry. Is okay. There someone who has
but you
been
pointed
waiting?
At.
No, I was gesturing.
Okay. I thought it was...
Okay. Now. Now that you're waiting. Now that you've been waiting, now you can talk.
Well, now, okay, I forget what I was going to say. Oh, okay. No, no. My point would be just to also say that I really appreciated your last comment, Bob, and to deal with the demon within, you know, the dark side of our own selves, and say, how much are we willing to change our own lifestyles? I don't mean what we're purchasing. I mean to change our associations sometimes, especially in my area. The biggest threat, I mean, I take young people down into Tijuana, and you should see the conversations I have to have with parents sometimes. They're freaked out. You're going to take them into Tijuana? I've had people, I've taken 15-year-old kids who live 45 minutes from Mexico who've never been there their whole life, and if their parents had the right...